Welcome back. We're continuing to work in Chapter 6 in the Yoga of Divine Works, the Ascent of the Sacrifice to the Works of Love, the Works of Life. Sri Aurobindo sat down three categories. The nature of the sacrifice that he's been going through, developing page after page, paragraph after paragraph. The first element, first category, is the nature of the act of the adoration that we offer to the divine. The second is the symbolic form of the act. And the third is the feeling of oneness, the inner component, as the fruit of that adoration. So, in the last few paragraphs that we were reading last week, he was describing the powerful emergence of the psyche, which leads to a greater union with the universe, with the cosmic being, that aspect of the all as it manifests. And the third would be the step into the transcendental power of the Supreme that enforces this experience of unity in the form. So now, we're ready to take up what he would call the last category of works. Into the third and last category of the works of sacrifice can be gathered all that is directly proper to the yoga of works. For here is its direct field of effectuation and major province. It covers the entire range of life's more visible activities. Under it fall the multiform energies of the will to life, throwing itself outward to make the most of material existence. It is here that an ascetic or otherworldly spirituality feels an insurmountable denial of the truth which it seeks after, and is compelled to turn away from terrestrial existence, rejecting it as forever the dark playground of an incurable ignorance. You'll recall that as Sri Aurobindo opens the Life Divine, chapter 2, the two negations, the materialist denial, and chapter 3, the two negations, the refusal of the ascetic, each closeting the precious part of existence that they will adhere to and excluding the other. So, life might be rambunctious, and so it's problematic to those with an ascetic turn, and yet our victory there is quite limited if we do force the renunciation of life. Yet, it is precisely these activities that are claimed for a spiritual conquest and divine transformation by the integral yoga. So in other words, Sri Aurobindo and those of us who join in the effort at an integral yoga, a yoga that integrates all the beings, saying stuff and nonsense. We're not going to deny the world. We are not going to throw out even the most ignorant or darkest forms of the energizing of the cosmic spirit. All is a manifestation of the divine, and our yoga would be incomplete, unfulfilled, if we left it out. Abandoned altogether by the more ascetic disciplines, accepted by others only as a field of temporary ordeal or a momentary, superficial, and ambiguous play of the concealed spirit, this existence is fully embraced and welcomed by the integral seeker as a field of fulfillment, a field for divine works, a field of the total self-discovery of the concealed and indwelling spirit. A discovery of the divinity in oneself is his first object. But a total discovery, too, of the divinity in the world behind the apparent denial offered by its scheme and figures. And last, a total discovery of the dynamism of some transcendent eternal. For by its descent, this world and self will be empowered to break their disguising envelopes and become divine in revealing form and manifesting process as they now are secretly in their hidden essence. So the integral yoga accepts life as a field of spiritual exploration and eventual fulfillment. Three things emerge: the personal, the psyche, the universal, the Atman as the world soul, and the transcendent as the Mahashakti, the power of the Supreme. All three must manifest, that is, become, let us say, stand in the front of the nature and claim suzerainty of all the parts of the being, mechanical, energetic, luminous, all must become one being, integrated. This object of the integral yoga must be accepted wholly by those who follow it. But the acceptance must not be in ignorance of the immense stumbling blocks that lie in the way of the achievement. On the contrary, we must be fully aware of the compelling cause of the refusal of so many other disciplines to regard even its possibility, much less its imperative character, as the true meaning of terrestrial existence. For here, in the works of life in the earth nature, is the very heart of the difficulty that has driven philosophy to its heights of aloofness and turned away even the eager eye of religion from the malady of birth in a mortal body to a distant paradise or a silent peace of nirvana. So what is more powerful than these achievements in the conscious being of humanity? Philosophy feels that it must abstract itself from the dualities of the world. Religion can't find a way to save it. Even the practical psychology of those who turn inwards to find the pure essence of consciousness and leave the forms behind can't find a means by which to discover that same spiritual essence in the outward world. It might be there, it might be hidden, but undiscoverable, and even if discoverable, not actionable. A way of pure knowledge is comparatively straightforward and easy to the tread of the seeker, in spite of our mental limitations and the pitfalls of the ignorance. A way of pure love, although it has its stumbling blocks and its sufferings and trials, can in comparison be as easy as the winging of a bird through the free azure. For knowledge and love are pure in their essence and become mixed and embarrassed, corrupted and degraded, only when they enter into the ambiguous movement of the life forces and are seized by them for the outward life's crude movements and obstinately inferior motives. So, heart opened, mind without the lid above, unwalled in its vistas, can work easily until they come into contact with the life force, which wants to use this greater brilliance and this firm and powerful emotional movement for its own satisfaction. Alone of the three powers, life, or at least a certain predominant will in life, has the appearance of something impure, accursed, or fallen in its very essence. Now, this isn't limited to the ascetic traditions of India, Buddhism, Jainism, those who follow Shankara's Advaita Vedanta and accepting sannyasa. But we also find it in Christianity. In many of the theistic religions, there's at least a component in which they want to pull away from contact with the world and isolate themselves as a corporate body in a monastery, etc., and live away. At its contact, wrapped in its dull sheaths or caught in its iridescent quagmires, the divinities themselves become common and muddy and hardly escape from being dragged downwards into its perversions and disastrously assimilated to the demon and the asura. A principle of dark and dull inertia is at its base. All are tied down by the body and its needs and desires to a trivial mind, petty desires and emotions, an insignificant repetition of small, worthless functionings, needs, cares, occupations, pains, pleasures that lead to nothing beyond themselves and bear the stamp of an ignorance that knows not its own why and whither. So the dark and dull inertia would be familiar to us in the scheme of Sankhya, which divides nature and soul, nature being Prakriti, and the dark element, the dark attribute of Prakriti is tamas. It is the principle of darkness and inertia. So, in its descent, the divine powers forget their own nature or ignore their own nature and become divided, diminished in their contact with the body and with the life power. He continues, this physical mind of inertia believes in no divinity other than its own small earth gods. It aspires, perhaps, to a greater comfort, order, pleasure, but asks for no uplifting and no spiritual deliverance. At the center, we meet a stronger will of life, with a greater gusto, but it is a blinded demon, a perverted spirit, and exults in the very elements that make of life a striving turmoil and an unhappy imbroglio. So let's look at some of the terminology that Sri Aurobindo has used here. He's used the term physical mind here and applied it to the energies of the will of life. Remember in 1932 when Sri Aurobindo was revising these chapters in the Synthesis of Yoga with an eye to publication. They didn't come out, these essays, until 1946. He begins most of his correspondence in 1931 and writes continuing up to 1950, but most of it concentrated in the early and late 1930s. As he goes along, he develops his terminology. Here he uses the term physical mind. It might be, in his later terminology, that he would have called this the physical vital. We see, even in his first compilations of letters to reach out and explain to the public in printed form what are the elements of his yoga, he took some of his correspondence and he published the first book, The Riddle of This World. We find no grand organization of the nature of being there. That was published in 1933. In 1935, I believe, he published Lights on Yoga. And in that, he pulled together a number of letters that described the planes and parts of the being, and we got the general idea of the distinctions among physical, vital, mental, subliminal, psyche, and the various ranges of the higher consciousness, higher mind, etc. So you can see that it took a few years to be able to bring all of this into an organized way. So if he uses a term here and there that seems a little out of place, it's a developing vocabulary. At the end of his correspondence, after everything was published, and really it was only recently published in its largest form, spread over four volumes, we can put together the general picture of what Sri Aurobindo's psychology was. But here, in 1932, as he was writing, he knew these things inwardly, but he's giving first expression to them. Even in The Life Divine, serialized in the Arya, he had not done this. In The Synthesis of Yoga, serialized in the Arya, he had not done this. So, a couple of other points here. The term demon here, it's not the demon, D-E-M-O-N, of later usage, which is a devil. But here, the demon is a spirit who exists between the empyrean of heaven and the solid earth below. So it's a sort of being that wanders between, but is naturally spiritual in its core. You might find it to be generally equatable with the term genius, as in the genius of the spot, genius loci. So he continues now, it is a soul of human or titanic desire clinging to the garish color, disordered poetry, violent tragedy or stirring melodrama of this mixed flux of good and evil, joy and sorrow, light and darkness, heady rapture and bitter torture. So this is the sort of stuff that will bring you a huge cinematic or Broadway success. But that is the general appetite of humanity. This is where most of humanity dwells, right there. And he calls it, at the center, we meet a stronger will of life. But this is not the refined spiritual part of our nature. As he says, it's a blinded demon, a perverted spirit that exults so. So this, if above, the principle of dark and dull inertia describes tamas, this here would describe the field of rajas. And back to the nature of the spirit that loves. It loves these things and would have more and more of them, or even when it suffers and cries out against them, can accept or joy in nothing else. It hates and revolts against higher things, and in its fury would trample, tear, or crucify any diviner power that has the presumption to offer to make life pure, luminous, and happy, and snatch from its lips the fiery brew of that exciting mixture. We don't want to let it go. Another will and life there is, that is ready to follow the ameliorating ideal mind and is allured by its offer to extract some harmony, beauty, light, nobler order out of life. But this is a smaller part of the vital nature and can be easily overpowered by its more violent or darker, duller yoke comrades. Nor does it readily lend itself to a call higher than that of the mind, unless that call defeats itself, as religion usually does, by lowering its demand to conditions more intelligible to our obscure vital nature. So this, again, would be an element of sattva. So if above, we would be talking about the physical, vital, inert in its nature, and the gusto of life, meaning that middle range of vitality, where it's wanting to devour and eat everything up that it can grasp, this would be the mental vital, but it's a smaller part of the being. Sri Aurobindo is not here constructing that very detailed picture of the inner workings of the cosmos and of the human, because microcosm is macrocosm, yes, that he depicts in The Life Divine. He's giving a general essay here. And after having finished The Life Divine, he did not come back to rework these chapters that he had arranged in 1932. Had he come back, it would have required a complete rewriting again. So, all these forces the spiritual seeker grows aware of in himself and finds all around him and has to struggle and combat incessantly to be rid of their grip and dislodge the long-entrenched mastery they have exercised over his own being as over the environing human existence. Well, so the aspirant comes to know the machinery, both inner and outer, because what describes our inner being is in deep connection to all the governing cosmos around. We live in that context. And so what we find in ourselves is out there too. It's as if the cosmological constant of Einstein is present in the inner workings of the world as well. So if we're aware of our inner being, of our soul, and we come out to explore, then we discover how difficult it's going to be, because there is chock full of difficulty every level of the nature. If we deal with life as it applies to the mind, if we deal with life as it applies to the body, it is life that connects mind and body after all. So if we're going to bring any kind of relative perfection to any of it, we have to bring it to all of it. So he continues, the difficulty is great, for their hold is so strong, so apparently invincible, that it justifies the disdainful dictum which compares human nature to a dog's tail. For straighten it, never so much by force of ethics, religion, reason, or any other redemptive effort, it returns in the end always to the crooked curl of nature. Now this was, you know, he doesn't agree with this perspective. And he loves Swami Vivekananda so much. He doesn't want any shade to fall on him. So this is one of the quotes that Swami Vivekananda made famous. So he does not directly attribute it. Perhaps I'm unkind to mention that. But the idea is that you can work on nature all you want to. As soon as you relieve the pressure, it goes back to what it was before. You can apply all the moral force you want into, you know, withstanding all the invitations of nature, all the subtleties and the seductions, etc. Take your eye off of it for a second, and boom, it's got you. So Sri Aurobindo doesn't much care for that philosophy, for that perspective. And so great is the vim. Well, let's pause there. Vim, that's from the Latin, from it's the accusative form of vis, which means force, and so it means energy or vigor, something powerful. And so great is the vim, the clutch of that more agitated life will, so immense the peril of its passions and errors, so subtly insistent or persistently invasive, so obstinate up to the very gates of heaven, the fury of its attack or the tedious obstruction of its obstacles, that even the saint and the yogin cannot be sure of their liberated purity or their trained self-mastery against its intrigue or its violence. And of course, all of spiritual history is filled with this, where as wise as a being might be, still there comes the moment where ignorance prevails. Still, there comes a moment where a relaxation leads to the indulgence in desires that the person thought that he was free of. Vishwamitra, great Vedic sage, etc., etc. All labor to straighten out this native crookedness strikes the struggling will as a futility. A flight, a withdrawal to happy heaven or peaceful dissolution easily finds credit as the only wisdom, and to find a way not to be born again gets established as the only remedy for the dull bondage or the poor shoddy delirium or the blinded and precarious happiness and achievement of earthly existence. So if you are able to capture that inner glow in the soul or reach above into the higher consciousness, you will be whipped so badly by entertaining some notion of changing nature that eventually you'll say, okay, no more for me. I quit the world. I'm going there to moksha, to nirvana, to heaven, but I'm leaving, and I'm leaving on Tuesday. So the paths of renunciation, though, are only a victory for the inner spirit, not for life. So the transformation of nature remains. So who will face this? Who will conquer the darkness and find the light inside the darkness, because there it sleeps, there it hides, except for the integral yogin? By whatever name, it's that spirit who insists on marrying all reality into one that will achieve. So, these sections in this chapter aren't conveniently divided. The asterisks that separate one section from another are too long for one evening and perhaps too short for two evenings, so I apologize. I think still that we should put our bookmark here, and we'll continue next week with a longer section. And we can read from Savitri. This is a section taken from Book 5, the Book of Love, and it's the Canto on Satyavan. Let's begin on page 397. On the dumb bosom of this oblivious globe, although as unknown beings we seem to meet, our lives are not aliens, nor as strangers join, moved to each other by a causeless force. The soul can recognize its answering soul across dividing time, and on life's roads, absorbed, rapt traveler, turning, it recovers familiar splendors in an unknown face, and touched by the warning finger of swift love, it thrills again to an immortal joy, wearing a mortal body for delight. There is a power within that knows beyond our knowings. We are greater than our thoughts, and sometimes earth unveils that vision here. To live, to love, are signs of infinite things. Love is a glory from eternity's spheres. Abased, disfigured, mocked by baser mites that steal his name and shape and ecstasy, he is still the Godhead by which all can change. A mystery wakes in our inconscient stuff. A bliss is born that can remake our life. Love dwells in us like an unopened flower awaiting a rapid moment of the soul, or he roams in his charmed sleep mid thoughts and things. The child God is at play. He seeks himself in many hearts and minds and living forms. He lingers for a sign that he can know, and when it comes, wakes blindly to a voice, a look, a touch, the meaning of a face. His instrument, the dim corporeal mind, of celestial insight, now forgetful grown, he seizes on some sign of outward charm to guide him mid the throng of nature's hints, reads heavenly truths into earth's semblances, desires the image for the Godhead's sake, divines the immortalities of form, and takes the body for the sculptured soul. Love's adoration, like a mystic seer, through vision looks at the invisible. In earth's alphabet finds a godlike sense, but the mind only thinks, behold the one for whom my life has waited long unfilled. Behold the sudden sovereign of my days. Heart feels for heart, limb cries for answering limb. All strives to enforce the unity all is. Too far from the divine, love seeks his truth, and life is blind, and the instruments deceive, and powers are there that labor to debase. Still can the vision come, the joy arrive. Rare is the cup fit for love's nectar wine, as rare the vessel that can hold God's birth. A soul made ready through a thousand years is the living mold of a supreme descent. These knew each other, though in forms thus strange, although to sight unknown, though life and mind had altered to hold a new significance, these bodies summed the drift of numberless births, and the spirit to the spirit was the same. Amazed by a joy for which they had waited long, the lovers met upon their different paths, travelers across the limitless plains of time, together drawn from fate-led journeyings in the self-closed solitude of their human past, to a swift, rapturous dream of future joy and the unexpected present of these eyes. By the revealing greatness of a look, form smitten, the spirit's memory woke in sense. The mist was torn that lay between two lives. Her heart unveiled, and his to find her turned. Attracted as in heaven star by star, they wondered at each other and rejoiced and wove affinity in a silent gaze. A moment passed that was eternity's ray. An hour began, the matrix of new time. End of Canto Two. What magnificent poetry. Well, thank you. It's always good to be with you. Much love. Namaste. Jai Ma.